Thank you. Thank you so, so much, Rabbi Katz, for the way overly gracious introduction, but especially for your friendship and for your being my lifeline, which I very, very sincerely appreciate. And it's wonderful to be here. Hello. And to discuss a topic which confounds many. How exactly do we understand the idea of the sale of chametz? And it may be a little startling to realize that we're just less now than 5 weeks away from Pesach. So it's on our calendars. It's on our appointment list already to meet with the rabbi and to arrange the sale of chametz. And that fact that we're doing this with premeditation, that we've been doing this every year and we know how it goes every year, and we have this scheduled that we sell our chametz and it doesn't actually leave our house and nothing changes. And we know inevitably after Pesach is over, it always comes back. It always returns to us. So are we playing a game? Are we cheating? What exactly is going on? How exactly do we understand this practice of selling chametz? And we should acknowledge that there is a history of some controversy. There were those who opposed the widespread practice of mechiras chametz, and there were those who had a mixed attitude to it. And to this very day, there are those who don't participate in the sale of chametz, or there are those who participate only a little bit. So, for example, there are many who don't sell absolute chametz. They don't sell actual bread, but they'll only sell chametz that is prohibited on a rabbinic level. And there are those who much more enthusiastically embrace the sale of chametz in the fullest sense. And there are those who advocate that everyone should sell chametz as a safeguard, even if they don't think they have any chametz. So we find a very broad range of attitudes towards the sale of chametz. So where exactly does it come from? What exactly are we accomplishing? What exactly are we doing? Are we playing a game? What's the story here? So the Mishnah does talk about selling chametz as an avenue for tashbisu, for fulfilling the mitzvah of getting rid of our chametz before Pesach. But it would seem that what the Mishnah is talking about is getting rid of it completely, selling the chametz and parting with it forever. The Tosefta, however, talks about something that on the surface seems much more similar to what we do. But nonetheless, there's still a question as to whether it really justifies the method that we have utilized today of this preordained and constant every year casual selling of chametz. The Tosefta tells a story, and the story itself may be significant. It's a question how much the story is a part of what we're talking about. The Tosefta tells a story about a man who's on a boat. And travel was even less predictable back then than it is now. So you're on the boat, and all of a sudden, it's Pesach time. And you have chametz with you. Presumably, it's not a bag of pretzels, but it's perhaps your livelihood. You deal in chametz in order to make a living. And if you're going to just throw this chametz over the side of the boat, that's going to be a very significant impact on your ability to feed your family. So what can you do? So the Tosefta describes a situation where you arrange with a non-Jewish fellow traveler to transfer the chametz into his possession for the duration of Pesach. And after Pesach, to reacquire it from him. And apparently, that's legitimate. Apparently, that works. And that was recorded in the Rambam and in the Shulchan Aruch as a workable plan. So far, so good. So far, that sounds very similar to what we do. There is, however, a clause. There is a condition that you find in some of the texts of the Rishonim. And it's not clear, we don't know for sure, whether they had that in their text of the Tosefta or whether it was added by some of the Rishonim. The exact origin of this clause is not clear where it started. But some of the Rishonim have a phrase when they bring this down, Ubilvad Shalo Ya'arim. as long as it's not a harama. So here is the key word. What exactly is a harama is a difficult word to translate, and that is at the center of the controversy relating to mechiras chametz and many other things. Harama is a word which can mean many things to many people. It's a word that can be neutral, a word that can be negative. It can be negative in many different ways. And in the context of Mechiras Chametz, we'll find that throughout the literature, there are many different ways to relate to it. So harama can be translated as evasive. It can be translated as false. It can be translated also in neutral ways. And there is an extensive debate, as we'll see, time permitting, as to how to relate to Mechiras Chametz. And we'll see as we look at some of the positions that there are no fewer than four ways to relate to Mechiras Chametz that emerge from the literature. There are those who feel that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, and there are those who feel that Mechiras Chametz is not a harama. And within the position that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, there are at least three ways to understand what that means. There are those who feel that it's a harama, but that's okay, because harama is a neutral term. It just means a alternative path, but it's not necessarily judgmental. And there are those who feel that it is a bad thing to do a harama. But within that, there are two ways to understand what type of bad harama is. There are those who understand it's bad because it's evasive, it's getting around an obligation. And there are those who understand that it's bad because it's false, because it's somehow fake. So that gives us four possibilities. That Mechiras Chametz is okay, it's not bad at all, it's not even a harama. Mechiras Chametz is a harama, but harama is itself a neutral term. Or Mechiras Chametz is a bad harama because harama is evasive, or it's bad because haramas are false. So far, so good. Everybody with me? So in this original Tosefta, some have the text that you can do this method that the story describes. You can transfer the ownership of the chametz to this non-Jewish fellow traveler, and you can reacquire it after Pesach, as long as it's not a harama. And the Rabbeinu Yerucham, quoted by the Beis Yosef quotes from one of the Shonim, what in the world does that mean? As long as it's not a harama, the whole thing is a harama. What does that mean, as long as it's not a harama? So you find in the Rishonim, you find in the commentaries, three different interpretations as to what that means. What is that condition? You can do this on one condition. What is the condition? As long as it's not a harama, what does that mean? So you find three different interpretations. One is bad news for us. One sounds like it's bad news, but turns out okay. And the other really is okay. So what are the three interpretations? The first one, that's bad news for us, is the position of the Ritva. The Ritva says, what does it mean you can do this as long as it's not a harama? It's okay to do this as long as you don't do it every year. That's bad news for us, because that would be a problem. Happens to be that no one quotes that lahalacha. That is not incorporated into any of the codifications, but that was a view in some of the Rishonim. There were others who felt that way as well, Maram Chalava, a few others, that's the condition the Rishonim meant, that it could be done occasionally. And some suggest that's why it's told in the form of the story. That you have somebody who is in a situation that wasn't anticipated, and perhaps it's his livelihood, and it's specific to those conditions. And it's noteworthy, maybe, that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch both codify this option, but the Rambam puts it in the context of the story, and the Shulchan Aruch doesn't. So is there any significance to the fact that the Rambam describes it with the story while the Shulchan Aruch doesn't? So some point out that the story makes it sound like it's an urgent, unplanned kind of situation. Somebody's livelihood depends on saving this chametz, and he got stuck on a boat and didn't know this was going to happen. And maybe it's only a situation like that where somebody should rely on this. But to do this every year with the pretzels that are in your kitchen, maybe that's not right. Maybe that's considered gaming the system. Maybe there's a reason it's described specifically in this context. Problem is, there is no indication otherwise in the Rambam that it's tied into those circumstances. And there are some who suggest that maybe it's actually the opposite message. Maybe the reason the Rambam includes the story is actually to show that it's actually much more latitude. Because clearly the person who has this with him on the boat never intended to genuinely sell it to the guy with him who was traveling, because why is he traveling somewhere with these wares if he wants to sell it to the passenger next to him? Clearly that was not his plan. So this is not his genuine intention, and it's clear that he's only doing this to address the Pesach situation. Nonetheless, it's still okay. So there are those who suggest that that's why the Rambam is including it, in order to show that even though his motive is only to address the Pesach problem, it's still okay despite that, and not to make the point that it's only okay because of the urgency. So this consideration of the Ritva, those Rishonim, that it's only legitimate when it's an urgent, unplanned situation, that could have been a big problem for us, but we don't find that accepted by any of the halachic codes. The second consideration that you find when we say that it can't be a harama is that this is something that has to have a condition attached to it, that the chametz has to be taken out of the house. So that seems like that's bad for us, because most of us, nowadays at least, don't take the chametz out of the house. So is that a problem for us if we don't take the chametz out of the house? And the Rishonim said that that had to be a condition. So not necessarily, because there has been an extensive evolution as to what exactly that condition was meant to address. And that's in the context of a discussion as to why it is that it's necessary to take the chametz out of the house. Because the Talmud says explicitly that if you have in your house chametz that is the property of a non-Jew, that's not a violation of the prohibition of ownership on Pesach. So why should there be a requirement to take it out of the house? And considering that, there was an extensive discussion, which the commentaries understood, you could satisfy this by, first of all, designating a special area in the house and leasing that area of the house to the purchaser, which is indeed what we do, and also providing access to the purchaser, which is also what we do. And that's in extensive literature. First of all, in the earlier generations, there was an insistence on providing the key to the purchaser. Nowadays, we more commonly provide combination codes or cell phone access, cell phone numbers. We make sure that there is actual access, but that was earlier generations in the form of a key. However it evolved, there are various ways to make sure that access is provided, but this seems to satisfy the condition that in the earlier Rishonim was described as actually taking the chametz out of the house. So that seems like that had been a problem for us, but apparently the way that that was interpreted by commentaries up to and including the Mishnah Berurah, that's not as much of a problem for us as it seems. The third condition, which actually seems to be the dominant interpretation and the one that's recorded in the Shulchan Aruch and elsewhere, the third condition is that it can't be what's called a matana almanas lahachzir. It can't be a conditional, contingent gift or sale. That you can't give the chametz to the non-Jew or sell it to him and say that this is only being given to you on condition that after Pesach it comes back to me. Now that is indeed in accordance with how we do things, despite the fact that yes, we know that every year he does indeed sell it back, that doesn't contradict the fact that it's never made explicitly conditional. There's no contradiction in those two statements. It's totally fine if you are completely confident that he will indeed sell it back to you, as long as that's not a condition of sale. The fact that he has complete freedom to choose to do whatever he wants, and should he decide that he wants to either keep it, and in which case he will have to pay the value, the way we do it nowadays is he essentially pays a down payment for the value of the chametz in advance, and with that down payment acquires ownership of all of the chametz, and then there's a debt for the rest. after Pesach, he has the option of paying the rest of the debt, or if he's not interested in paying the rest of the debt, then he also has the option of selling it back instead of paying the rest of the debt. But he also could choose to keep the chametz and pay the debt. And if he does that, we're totally okay with that too. And it's necessary, based on these rules, that there's no constraints on him. If he chooses to keep it, he is absolutely entitled to do that. So that's the way we carry out the sale of the chametz. So this condition, we are very careful to stick to. It is a discussion as well as to why this condition is there also, because it's not immediately obvious as to why that had to be a condition, because the Talmud says that matana amanas lahachzir shmei matana, that if one gives a matana that is contingent on return, that actually still is considered to be a gift, meaning that for the duration of the term of the gift, it is the property of the recipient. So despite the fact that there is a condition to return later, during the time of the gift, it is their property fully. So theoretically, that should work in terms of ownership. So it's not obvious as to why that condition has to exist. There are those who suggest that maybe that's just too much of a joke, and the chumrah of chametz means that that's not appropriate. Or there are those who thought there may be a more genuine issue there, that maybe if he's burdened with a responsibility of returning it afterwards in a legal sense, so therefore he will feel an obligation now to guard it on your behalf. And if he's guarding it on behalf of the Jew, that is some form of liability and ownership towards the Jew, and therefore that does incur some Pesach responsibility. So maybe that is actually more of a technical problem. So it was a discussion as to why exactly that condition exists. But one way or another, that is the condition that we're careful for, and we don't put any responsibilities or conditions at all, and we assume that the sale is absolute and final. It is the absolute property of the purchaser, and he is completely at liberty to keep it, under which circumstance he will pay for it, or he is at liberty to sell it to whoever he wants after Pesach, and again, he'll bear the responsibility to pay back for whatever he sells. And he has also complete access to it over the course of Pesach. Should he want to take it? Should he want to do whatever he wants? All of that we're very careful about, and all time permitting, say a little bit more about that as well. This condition, that there can't be any conditions, that it has to be completely unencumbered, was the topic of a tshuva that I found very fascinating, very striking, of the Maasas Binyamin, who wrote in the 1600s. And he was very troubled. He said that he couldn't sleep at night because he had a problem which he didn't know how to solve. And he was troubled as follows. Apparently, they did things a little differently back then. It wasn't necessarily the down payment system that I was describing a minute ago. But they would sell the chametz for a fraction of the value, let's say for 1% of the price to the non-Jewish purchaser. And then they would buy it back after Pesach at 2% of the price. So the purchaser would make a little bit of a profit, and that was what was in it for him, and that was how they did it. So apparently there were unscrupulous Jews who, after Pesach, before the original purchaser, for the original owner, was able to come and buy back his chametz at 2%, so this other guy would come in and buy it at 3%. So he would get a literal steal, and the original owner would lose his whole livelihood. He would lose all of the chametz that he needed to make a living. So the Maasas Binyamin wrote that he didn't know what to do. It kept him up at night because, on the one hand, this was the livelihood of his population. The Jews were in the liquor business, many of them, and this was how they made a living. And if they can't find a way to sell their chametz and get it back after Pesach, so then they're not going to be able to survive economically. But on the other hand, if he's going to make a condition on the sale, if he's going to tell the purchaser that he has to sell it back to this guy and he can't sell it to somebody else, so then he's going to compromise the integrity of the sale. So how does he balance these two considerations, maintain the integrity of the sale and not put any conditions on it, and at the same time protect the livelihood of this original Jewish seller and make sure that no interloper comes and swoops in and buys it away before he gets a chance to buy it? And he wrote that he couldn't sleep at night. He was so concerned and anguished about this. And indeed, he comes up with a brilliant solution. What's the brilliant solution? You'll have to buy the book to find out. That was a little bit more complicated than we probably have time for, but I was just very struck with just how concerned he was with this issue. And it's emblematic of what you find in terms of rabbinic responsibility throughout the generations and the concern that was brought to all of these issues. So this question of how to prevent mechiras chametz from being a harama is something that was brought up by the Rishonim, and it was debated in later generations. So I mentioned all the four different ways of relating to it. This came up again in the 1700s, because in the 1700s, there was a great authority, Rabbi Alexander Shor, who wrote a sefer called Bechor Shor on the Gemara. He wrote also a sefer called Tvua Shor on issues of Shechita and things like that. And a comment that he had in the Sefer Bechor Shor was very widely quoted and very widely influential, but was also very widely debated and disputed, and has been the topic of much argumentation for the past 300 years, that he asserted three premises. He said, Mechiras Chametz is a harama. And there's also a rule, haramos are only acceptable by rabbinic law, cannot be used for Torah law. But mechiras chametz still can be done because our chametz is only an issue of rabbinic law. Why is that true? Doesn't the Torah prohibit us from owning chametz on Pesach? So the point he was making is based on a statement in the Talmud. The Talmud says that because we do bittul chametz, because we declare our chametz to be ownerless, so that addresses the prohibition of owning chametz on a Torah level. So these were his three principles, that mechiras chametz is a harama. You can't use that when dealing with Torah law, but luckily we're only dealing with rabbinic law. So this was a major debate, and there were four positions as to how to relate to his opening statements here. There were those who argued on all three points. There were those who said mechiras chametz is not a harama, as I mentioned. The Chassam Sofer, for example, was very vocal on this point. He thought either that mechiras chametz is not a harama, or that it's a neutral harama. It's a harama that we don't have to judge negatively in any way. And he wrote extensively about that in a number of responsa. And there were those who disputed that there's any limitation anyway between Torah law and rabbinic law, and debated his sources. That was a whole very extensive literature. And they also disputed his third point, because the idea that we're only dealing with rabbinic law here is not necessarily the case, because even if you do bittul chametz and you declare your chametz to be ownerless, and it's true, the Talmud says that that addresses the Torah responsibility, but many objected that we're not talking about the same chametz. The chametz that you negate in your house, that you do bittul, is not the same chametz that you sell. The chametz that you do bittul on is the chametz that's under the couch that you don't know about. To say that you can both declare the chametz as meaningless to you and sell the chametz, many thought, understandably, that that's a contradiction in terms. How can you sell something that you declare to be meaningless? Presumably, it's two separate sets of chametz. There's the chametz that you don't know about, that you don't expect to ever meet up with again, so that you declare to be meaningless and nothing. And there's the chametz that you do plan on meeting up with again. That's not a part of the bittul, and that is subject to a Torah prohibition if it's actual bread. And therefore, if you plan on selling that, then you have to man up and realize that you're dealing with actual Torah concepts there. And they disputed that premise as well. So there's basically four attitudes in terms of the Bechor Shor's view. There were those who accepted all three of his premises, those who argued on all three of his premises, and those who split. So there are some who split the Chumra and took the first two premises and said that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, you shouldn't use it for Torah law, but assumed that our Chametz is a Torah issue, so therefore took a stringent position across the board. And there were some who split the Kula, didn't accept the first two, but accepted his Kula about Bittul Chametz, and therefore felt that you could be lenient by many questions of Mechiras Chametz because they took only the third premise. That's a difficult position, but there are four attitudes towards the Bechor Shor's opening statement here, and it goes around this whole question of how to relate to the central issue of what Mechiras Chametz is, and it's really what was discussed in the earlier generations, hundreds of years before, the Rishonim argued as to how to make sure that Mechiras Chametz isn't a harama, and what are the considerations we have to address in order to make sure that it wouldn't be labeled that way. What the Bechor Shor was really worried about was really the sincerity. And for him, the devil was really in the details. It wasn't a yes or no question. It was more about how it was done, and that was clear from the way he discussed it, that he was worried that the parties weren't actually sincere and didn't actually mean it. And therefore, if all the details could be addressed and could be enhanced, and we find that Mechiras Chametz has indeed been an evolving process throughout the centuries and throughout the generations, and Poskim have continuously evaluated and reevaluated and looked how could they make it better, and how could they address all of the different details to make sure that it's as sincere and as genuine a process as possible. So the more those different aspects have been addressed, the greater it is, and presumably that makes a big difference. And it does seem to be that to the extent there is a greater level of sincerity and attention to details, the Bechor Shor himself probably would acknowledge that it is a more valid process. And as the Stechemet pointed out, that if you look carefully at the language, the Bechor Shor he himself writes that it is likely that when it is done sincerely, that he would endorse the actual act of Mechiras Chametz. And the truth is, most of his objection was really to something else. He was talking about what was going on in his day. It wasn't just the chametz they were selling. They were selling animals that they were worried that over the course of Pesach, the feed for the cows was chametz and the other feed was far inferior. So the animals were getting skinnier over the course of Pesach. So what they would do is they would sell the cows to the non-Jewish neighbor, so that they could feed chametz to the cows over the course of Pesach. And he thought that was an overt joke, because he thought there was no credibility to that, to say that you're actually selling your cows, these expensive animals, over the course of Pesach to people who can't afford them at all, just so that they don't get skinnier for a week. He thought that had no credibility to it at all, and that was a total fake out. And that, he said, there, that's Torah law, to benefit from chametz over the course of Pesach. Straight out, your animals are going to be eating actual chametz over the course of Pesach, and there's no real sincerity to the sale. He thought that was completely fake, and that was a violation of Torah law under a complete pretense. So that was what really bothered him the most, and it was in that context that he brought up this whole issue. But he has actually a line there which tends to get overlooked. He says, but when it comes to chametz itself, it is possible that people may do that sincerely, because they actually have no other alternative. It's either sell it sincerely or destroy it. So maybe they do it sincerely, so it's all in the details. And as the Stechemet points out, if they do it sincerely, then okay, he would acknowledge that that is possibly a valid approach, as the Chasam Sofer indeed argued with him and took that position. So just to mention one other controversy that took place, let's see, time permitting how much more we can say, but one other controversy that took place while this process of evolution was going on, of this constant effort to try to enhance what was going on and to make sure that the details were done in the best way possible. So it used to be, before a few hundred years ago, the way chametz was sold is everyone did it on a one-to-one basis. So individuals would sell their chametz to their non-Jewish neighbors. And it wouldn't necessarily always go well, because it's very complicated to sell chametz. The kinyanim are very complicated, and it's very easy to make a mistake. And just to mention two of the mistakes that are easiest to make that would really invalidate the whole process. So first of all, if you make the sale contingent on paying the full sum, so that would invalidate everything retroactively, because since the purchaser generally does not pay the whole sum after Pesach, so if you made it contingent on that, so then the sale would retroactively be nullified and nothing will be accomplished. So we have to be very careful not to structure the sale that way. We make the sale completely final before Pesach with that down payment, and the rest is structured as a debt. But one could easily make a mistake and say, okay, the sale is contingent on the full sum being paid, and that's a mistake that would invalidate the whole process. Or if you're a little bit late and you sell the chametz after the Zman Isser Hanal Chametz, so then it's impossible to sell at that point. So if you're just a little bit careless with the time, so then again, the whole process is going to be completely ineffective. So it's very easy to make a mistake. Those are just two of the most blatant mistakes, but there are many other mistakes that could be made. So it was clearly a fraught experience. So one of the ways in which they tried to enhance the process is about 200 years ago, 300 years ago, they tried having collective sales. What we have now is very different. What we have now is instead of the individual sale, is we use the rabbi usually as an agent, as a power of attorney. That's really a technical term, is maybe not accurate, but as an agent on behalf of his congregants. He is empowered by the congregants to sell the chametz on their behalf. So hopefully the rabbi is more well-versed in all of the details, and he acts as their agent, and he sells collectively for everybody. So in between, while it was transitioning from the individual one-to-one sale, which was so fraught, and what we have today, there was a point about 300 years ago where what they were doing in communities was you would have one Jew in the community who would buy the chametz of all the other Jews. And then that one Jew would sell all that chametz to one non-Jew. So that was happening in communities in Poland and Russia and Ukraine and in Romania. And there was a huge controversy that erupted in one of the cities in Romania, in Jos, called Jassy. And the two rabbis who were in the town over there at that time, they very much disagreed about this process. One was organizing the collective sale, and the other one very much opposed it and said that that's just too much of a harama. That's a harama on top of a harama, because it's one thing, okay, to believe that an individual is selling his chametz over the course of Pesach, but to believe this, that all the Jews in the town are selling to this one guy who's not in business the whole rest of the year, he's buying everyone else's chametz, and he's selling all of that to this one non-Jew who can't afford any of it, so it's impossible for me to believe. So that's just a harama on top of a harama, and that we can't sustain, and that's a terrible plan. So they had a huge fight about this, and they brought in one of the great gedolim, one of the most prolific authors, Rav Shlomo Kluger. And Rav Shlomo Kluger authored a long tshuva about this, where he validated this process. He acknowledged that it is tricky, and he said that individuals who are God-fearing and who know what they're doing, maybe they should continue to do it one-on-one. But for the community as a whole, for the masses, you need to have a system like this in order to make sure that some of the problems are fixed. And he has a fascinating whole speech there where he says that the opponents, they're not experienced with being a rabbi in a big city, and you don't know the kind of things that can go wrong, and you have to be aware of the kinds of challenges that are present in these situations, and you have to pick the lesser of the two evils, and you have to be sensitive to all of the issues that people have, and you have to recognize why you sometimes have to take plans like this, and they're right to do that. And he wrote about all this, and the response is a very fascinating approach. So this is among the things that have been done to improve the process. And since then, that changed. And now we don't have anything like that usually. It's not that one Jew, whether it's the rabbi or somebody else, purchases it from the other Jews. That's not what happens anymore, for the most part, at least from what we're aware of. Rather, the rabbi acts as the agent. He doesn't purchase it at all, but he is empowered by the congregants to sell on their behalf. And for the most part, that has many advantages over the earlier process. There's a few disadvantages also. So there's interesting questions that can come up with both models. But for the most part, that's a smoother system. And that is generally what we do. So with all this, the question can be asked before we run out of time. So given all of the controversies, and given the various objections that have been raised, and given the fact that we know inevitably that the chametz does tend to return to us after Pesach, and given that It doesn't intend to leave our house at all during the course of Pesach. And we've been doing this for many, many years, all of our lives. And maybe we've never seen the non-Jew ever come and take any of it. Maybe we have, but we probably haven't. So given all of that, why have we embraced Mechiras Chametz to the extent that we have? And I'll say, full disclosure, I fully embrace Mechiras Chametz. So why has Klal Yisrael, to the extent that they have, embraced Mechiras Chametz to such a level? So perhaps we could suggest something along the following lines. So the question of the prohibition of owning chametz in the first place, the prohibition of bal yirah bal yimatzeh, which is a Torah prohibition, or is two Torah prohibitions, depending on how you count. So why is it that the Torah prohibited us to own chametz on Pesach? There is a comment of the Ran in the beginning of Maseches Pesachim, which some maintain is actually the view of all of the Rishonim, that the reason the Torah prohibits us from owning chametz on Pesach is what was later termed by Rabbi Yosef Engel and others a siag min haTorah, that this is a Torah prohibition that functions similar to the way rabbinic prohibitions work, meaning that it's primarily there to protect another Torah prohibition. That really the Torah doesn't want us to eat chametz on Pesach. And in order to keep us from eating chametz on Pesach, there's another prohibition that we shouldn't even own chametz on Pesach. So you might ask, well, there's a lot of things we're not allowed to eat, and we don't have a parallel prohibition. We're not allowed to eat pork, and yet you don't find that we're prohibited from owning pork. How come there isn't something comparable? So as the Rishonim explained, there are two different kinds of factors that make it distinct. That first of all, chametz is a more severe prohibition than pork. There's an iser kares associated with eating chametz. And there's a psychological factor that we are not habituated to avoid chametz. So if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're hungry and there's a, for whatever reason, a pork sandwich in your fridge, so you're not likely to accidentally eat the pork sandwich. But if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning on Pesach and there's a peanut butter sandwich in your fridge, you may accidentally eat the peanut butter sandwich because you're not in the habit of avoiding peanut butter sandwiches. So we have to be more careful about that, the combination of the two factors. So we're told that we can't even have chametz in our house because of the risk of eating it. So perhaps we have developed the following position, that if we want to make sure that we are not going to even inadvertently eat chametz on Pesach, there are two approaches we can take to guarantee that we won't. One is simply to not have any access to any chametz, not have any in our house. The other is perhaps there will be chametz in our house, but if that chametz is not our property and there is a prohibition of gezel that is attached to that chametz, and we fully revere the prohibition of chametz, the prohibition of gezel, and monetary rights are fully respected, and we are not going to touch somebody else's property, so that will also keep us away from eating chametz on Pesach. So the fact that the chametz comes back to us after Pesach, and the fact that it is not actually removed from our property over our house over the course of Pesach doesn't change the fact that it is somebody else's property during those 8 days. And there's a prohibition of gezel that is associated with it. So if we have full respect for the monetary rights, and we are indeed not going to touch it because of that, so then that should have the intended effect of keeping us from eating the chametz. I mentioned this once to somebody and he asked, so then would we say that if somebody cheats on his taxes, so we shouldn't let them sell the chametz? So, yeah, maybe, could be, because what's necessary here is that one has to have an absolute commitment to two principles. One, to the monetary principles involved, that there is an absolute prohibition of gezel involved, and that it is a absolute sale. So all of the conditions of the sale have to be respected 100%. And the idea that there is a absolute prohibition of gezel that is involved. So therefore, some of the questions that sometimes come up regarding the Mechiras Chametz it's important that for this to have the full intended effect, that one shouldn't have an attitude of, well, he's probably mochel, he probably doesn't mind if I do this, if I do that, but one should be very careful to have the attitude that the chametz is fully sold and is completely not mine, it is completely the property of somebody else, and I don't have the right to take any liberties with it. And if there is a need to take a liberty with for whatever reason, so for example, the discussion sometimes comes up of Erev Pesach, Shechal Yos B'Shabbos, and there's a need to separate out some rolls to use for the meal for the Shabbos before Pesach starts. So then you ask permission and you designate that specifically and you make clear that this is something that's going to be used and you work that out as part of the sale. And nothing should be assumed. Everything should be carefully designated. And there's a fascinating tshuva, for example, of Rav Shlomo Kluger, where there was a situation where, and there's a couple of tshuvas like this, a fascinating tshuva where there was somebody who was ready to purchase his chametz back after Pesach, and the non-Jew who he had sold it to ended up getting arrested over the course of Pesach. So he was inaccessible. He was away in jail. And now he didn't know what to do because he couldn't get to this guy, and he figures, okay, so the chametz is in my house, so I could just take it. So, and he hasn't paid me for it anyway, so let me just take it. And Shlomo Kluger wrote to him, he says, no, you can't do that, because even though he hasn't paid you for it, and even though you have access to it, you still have to treat it as if it's somebody else's. So even though you have a claim, so you have to go to a Beis Din and make your claim and say that this is the property somebody else owes you for, and let them go through a process, and then you'll claim it. But to just go and take it because you believe you have a right to it is not the way to go about things. So you have to have that mentality throughout, and then that's going to be effective in order to keep you away from the chametz over the course of Pesach. And perhaps we could suggest a little bit further that this developed as a proactive minhag, because here Pesach is a time when we focus on themes of geula, of past and future geula. And the Smach writes, the Smach from Mitzvah Cotton writes, that the Jews cannot be redeemed if they're not perceived as people of honesty and integrity, because it'll be a chil Hashem, because the nations of the world will say, why is God redeeming this nation that is not honest and possessed of integrity? So perhaps we've developed this custom that Pesach time, we specifically and proactively engage in a business transaction with the Umos HaOlam, and we go out of our way to show just how careful we are about this transaction and just how much we uphold all of the details and the integrity of that transaction. And through that, it should be a Kiddush Hashem, and it should be a display of honesty and integrity. And through that, and through the actual sincerity of that process, it should be a step towards the geula that we so desperately need this year more than ever, and we should indeed merit feeling and experiencing true and genuine lasting redemption, the Karav Bimeinu. I thank you so much, and we should know only good things. Okay.
Thank you so much. There are books for sale. And we'll dive in Marav in 5 minutes.